So we are in Acts. This is our third time in Acts, our third night in Acts, and we're looking at eschatology going all the way through the Bible, but in Acts, just a few things that pop up in Acts that are interesting. One is, remember, we've crossed over into the New Testament where there's now things are being fulfilled, things that were prophesied in the Old Testament about eschatology. They're beginning to be fulfilled, like with the coming of the Christ, the resurrection. And then in Acts, this right here, the Gentiles, the going to the Gentiles, that was something that was prophesied that was going to take place. And remember, the book of Acts begins, as does Hebrews, that these are those days. These are the last days that we are in. And the disciples began the book of Acts by asking Jesus, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? And he says, it's not for you to know the times or dates, which means, doesn't mean, no, I'm not going to restore it to Israel. It means we're going to do something first. And that's where the Gentiles, as it was prophesied in the Old Testament, was going to take place. The other thing that we're going to see is the resurrection. It's not just the resurrection of Jesus, but the resurrection in the future, the things that are going to take place. We have hints of it. I think it's clear in the Old Testament that there's going to be a resurrection. Job mentions it. We know David talks about it. The Jews seemed to be anticipating some kind of a day in the future. There are different groups of Jews, even the Sadducees, like we said last week, didn't accept the resurrection from the dead or even life after death. But with the coming of Christ and his teaching, with his resurrection, the things that take place in Acts, this becomes an absolute truth in Christianity. And we can see that. I'm going to have several verses here we're going to look at. And the resurrection is part of an eschatological event that will take place. And so I just want to read through these verses and see what takes place. We are going to start in Acts chapter 22, verse 21. And what is taking place here is Paul is being arrested on the Temple Mount. If you remember, Acts chapter 2, verse 21, if you remember, Paul had been in Corinth. He'd been over in the West, and this could become a long, drawn-out story, but here we're going to go with, this is Corinth over here. Here's Asia Minor over here with Ephesus, and then we're going to come down here, and Jerusalem is right here. And Paul had been spending time in Corinth. It's 57 A.D., He'd been going back and forth, you know, talking with from the Ephesus and back and forth with Corinth. He's written 1st and 2nd Corinthians. Actually, he's written Romans and sent it over to Rome. But at this time, he's going to go to Jerusalem, and he's got an offering. He's got a lot of money that he's collected from the Gentile churches to donate to the suffering Christians, the Jewish believers in Jerusalem. Now, they're suffering because of persecution. They're suffering because there was a famine that had moved through just around, you know, within the last few years. But they're short on money. And the Gentile, he's trying to show unity. Well, he's doing doing the right thing. But as far as, you know, church politics, he's showing unity to the Jews that the Gentiles are on the same team. He's trying to bring this unity of the church of the out of two men, the Jews and the Gentiles. God has formed the one, the body of Christ. And so he's bringing this money down, and he brings the money down to Jerusalem with an escort going with him. Several Gentiles are coming with him. And he meets with the leaders of the church, James and others, makes the offering. They appreciate it. There's some Pharisees there. And they begin to talk to him and saying, Paul, there are some people here in town that have a hard time with you because you've gone to the Gentiles. And they hear you're teaching against the law of Moses and not teaching circumcision and all these things. Well, and that is true. He's not telling the Gentiles they need to be circumcised. But he hasn't turned his back on the Old Testament teaching or even on the Jewish culture. And so, and this is interesting, especially when Protestants find this out, that he accepts, they say, we would like you to go up to the Temple Mount. And James was going to the Temple Mount. The Christians even met on the Temple Mount. And he is going to go up and take a vow on the Temple Mount and is actually going to pay for some other men to take a vow and have their heads shaved and have that part of the offering. Kind of, it seemed like it was some kind of a Nazarite vow, a personal commitment. Well, while he was up there, some of his enemies, some of the Pharisees that it would appear, the Pharisees that were against his teaching, they said that he brought a Gentile into the Jewish part of the temple Temple Mount. There was the Gentiles had a portion they could go into, and then there's a closer place where the Jews could cross over. There's a court for the women, and then the Jewish men could go. I mean, this is completely anti-American. It's like, oh my gosh, cancel this. But then the Jewish men could get in closer, and of course the priests could get up closer and go into the temple, and the high priest could only go into the most holy place once a year. So there's clearly a hierarchy, and the high priest could only go in once a year. So even the Jewish men were limited. Even the Levites were limited. Even the priests were limited. Only the high priest could go. Nonetheless, they say that they started a rumor that Paul had brought a Gentile into the Jewish quarter, into the Jewish portion of the Temple Mount. And thus, a riot is going to break out. And that's where we find ourselves in Acts chapter 22. I'm going to begin in Acts chapter 21. Chapter 21, verse 27. When the 7 days were nearly over, and this is the 7 days of the vow, Paul had gone up there and they'd taken the vow, and now he's going up on the Temple Mount. Some Jews from the province of Asia that were familiar with his work here in Asia, they're back down here in Jerusalem. They stirred up the whole crowd after they saw Paul in the temple, and they started shouting, and the whole crowd, and seized him, shouting, "Men of Israel, help us. This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people, our law, and this place. And besides, he has brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled this holy place." And now that had not happened, Paul knows enough. In fact, there's boundary stones, a border going around where, and with signs on it, and we have found two of them written in Greek, telling the Greeks, you cannot go beyond this point. It's the barrier, the dividing wall of partition. Some people think it's referred to in the book of Galatians. But it, meaning right here, if you cross this line, your death is your own fault. Do not cross this line. And we have found two of them, archaeologies. One had tumbled down into the Kidron Valley, and the other, I'm not sure where it was found, but they are from the Temple Mount with that very warning on there. Josephus refers to it, and we've got two stones. Anyway, they said that he'd gone across with a Gentile into that area. And so now the whole temple is now desecrated. It's got to be shut down and go through cleansing. And so this is a very serious thing. But it's a lie. It's a fabrication. It's false news. It's false media. And besides, he's brought Greeks into this temple area and defiled this holy place. Parentheses here, verse 29. They had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with Paul. And Trophimus had traveled with him to Jerusalem. He's from Ephesus, and they'd seen him in the city with Paul. But that doesn't mean Paul had taken him up on the Temple Mount, nor would Paul have done that because he was a faithful Jew. They had previously seen Trophimus with the Ephesian in the city with Paul, and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple area. No, that's right, assumed. The whole city was aroused, and the people came running from all directions, seizing Paul. They dragged him from the temple, and immediately the gates were shut. So they dragged him from the temple, and they shut the gates because it's defiled. You can't worship today. We've got to clean the temple. While they were trying to kill him, news reached the commander of the Roman troops that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. And at once, he took some officers and soldiers and ran down to the crowd. Then the rioters saw the commander and the soldiers. They stopped beating Paul. So here's what's taking place now in Jerusalem there on the Temple Mount. Here's a real quick drawing of the Temple Mount. And the temple would be sitting here. Up here is Fort Antoninus. You can still see some of the wall right here. This would be like the temple courts. This would be the outer court. There'd be the court for the men, the court for the women. And then out here somewhere, and this is a very rough drawing, the Gentiles could cross here. And right in here would be a wall saying you can't come any closer. Well, they took Paul out of this court. He was still on the Temple Mount area where they're beating him. But the gates of the temple had been closed. The gates of these had been closed. The place was empty out. And there's a mob now beating Paul. Fort Antonia, the governor, or the governor, the commander of the Roman garrison. This is a Roman station. Herod had built it. It's named after Fort Antonius, after his friend Anthony, Mark Antony. And And there's steps going up to this where they could oversee the Temple Mount. In fact, it was looking down, they'd oversee the feast days. The Romans would watch this because they're under Jewish occupation. The Jews were under Roman occupation beginning sometime around 63 BC. Well, anyway, the commander sends his troops down here. What's going on? He sees the commotion. He's not going down there to save Paul. The Romans want order. They want things kept in line. So, then once they see the commander coming down, they stop beating. Verse 33, the commander came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. Then he asked who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd shouted one thing and some another thing. And since the commander could not get at the truth because of the uproar, he ordered that Paul be taken into the barracks, Fort Antoni, where the soldiers stay. When Paul reached the steps, the violence of the mob was so great, he had to be carried by the soldiers. The crowd that followed kept shouting, "Away with him." So the commander thinks we've got ourselves a serious person, a serious player in this Jewish conflict that they've got going on. He has no idea who it is, but as he's bringing up the step, they're bringing up these steps, the crowd is mobbing around. They're carrying Paul up for protection. Now, the commander still doesn't know who Paul is, nor does he care about the Jewish rituals. This is why Paul is going to end up in Roman prison. He's going to be in prison from 57 to 62 AD. 3 years in Caesarea and 2 years in Rome under house arrest. That's when he writes the letter of Ephesians, Colossians, Philemon. He's writing the prison epistles at that time. He's under house arrest. People are coming and visiting. We'll see as the book goes on. People are going to come and visit, but he is now locked up for 5 years because of this event. He's going to appear before Nero. At least, I would say, two times at this moment. And later on, when he's going to be decapitated in 67 or 68, he's going to be arrested again. And that time, Nero's going to see him again, and he's going to be killed. This time, Nero's going to hear the case, and he's going to dismiss it. Because it's going to go from Jerusalem, right here in the Temple Mount, all the way to Rome. And it doesn't appear anybody is going to follow and even make charges against him. Paul's going to appeal his case because he's a Roman citizen. He can appeal his case to Nero. He's going to appear before Nero, present his case, and there's apparently no accusers there in Rome. And Nero's not concerned about Jewish law, doesn't understand Jewish law, sees it as, I don't understand. No, I'm not sure what he did, but he dismisses it. This one right here, he takes it serious. Of course, the persecutions had broken out beginning in 64. So Paul just missed Nero's persecutions being released in 62. And Nero, I would guess, and if we read here, we can hear what Paul would have said. We don't know what Paul said to Nero, except that he testified, he held to the truth. But we can hear him talking to Felix, Festus, and Agrippa here in the end of Acts, and hear what he would say to someone like a king, a proconsul, a governor, or to Nero. And so that, anyway, when they're carrying him away. As the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, Paul asked the commander, "May I say something to you?" So he's up high enough up onto Fort Antoni. "Can I say something to you?" And the commander, watch the commander. "Do you speak Greek?" he replied. You know, in other words, he thought it's like, you're speaking Greek. It's like, what? You aren't who I thought you were. He says, "Aren't you the Egyptian who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago?" Paul answered, "I am a Jew." Now, again, get that right there. He thought this was maybe a Jew coming out of Egypt that led 4,000 men, got a revolt started. And remember, this is 57 AD. The Jewish wars are going to break out in 66 AD, where the whole nation's going to go to war against Rome. So this is just 9 years away. Now, you think 9-11, 2001, that was just a few years ago. I mean, you know, that was 20 years ago. This was only 9 years away from the Jewish wars breaking out. So things are already, there's already tension. And they'd taken an Egyptian, apparently a Jewish Egyptian, come up and led 4,000 men out into the wilderness. And the reason they take them out into the wilderness is prepare for an invasion. That's what we see when Jesus talks eschatology. He says, they say, "Hey, he's out in the wilderness," or "he's in an inner room." Don't believe him. He says, "I'm going to come back like lightning from the east to the west. I'm not going to come back like some revolutionary taking my troops and organizing out in the wilderness and then marching on Jerusalem. Nor am I going to go to the inner rooms around the precincts in the temple." They had all kinds of rooms, buildings around where the priests kept their clothes, where they'd have meetings. The Sanhedrin meet here. They had the a Solomon's colonnade, all columns around this beautiful walkway here with rooms and meeting places all around there. So this would be one of the inner rooms where the Messiah could come back and be negotiating. So typically right here, he thought, the commander thinks Paul, the reason they are upset with him is that he's the commander, or the terrorist, came out of Egypt, got 4,000 men to go out in the wilderness to get ready to march on Jerusalem. This was a common occurrence during these days. Eventually, it's actually going to take place. They're actually going to march on Rome in Jerusalem in several occasions. I mean, the Jewish wars is an incredible story. So that's what they're uptight. They realize we're in a tense situation. He says, "Aren't you the Egyptian who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago?" Paul answered, "I am a Jew from Tarshish in Cilicia, a citizen of no ordinary city." Meaning he's a Jew, but he is a Roman citizen, born a Roman citizen. And he's used that get-out-of-jail-free card several times after the Philippi situation, where he got beat because he didn't pull out his citizenship card on time, and they beat him for being a Jew. And then the next day he says, "But I'm a citizen." And they, oh my gosh, and everybody just disappeared. Well, you're going to see the same thing happen right here. Having received the commander's permission, verse 39, Paul answered, "I'm a citizen of no ordinary city. Please let me speak to the people." Now, again, this is typical Paul. If there's a group, can I say something to them? I mean, he's got, now watch, this is just crazy, amazing. Paul is like, they're beating him. They're beating him. He's misidentified. He's on the steps ready to go into the barracks for protection and questioning. And he gets the commander's attention, says, can I say something to you? He says, well, just by saying, "Can I say something to you?" It's like, changes the whole situation. "I thought you were a terrorist from Egypt." It's like, "You're a Greek." "Yeah, I'm from Tarshish." It's like, "That's no ordinary city. I'm a citizen." It's like, "Now, can I say something to these people?" And it's like, "No, get in the building." It's like, and the commander says, "Okay." And so now Paul's going to stand on the steps of Fort Antonia and address the crowd that was just beating him to death. Here it is. "Please let me speak to the people." Having received the commander's permission, Paul stood on the steps and motioned to the crowd. Shh, or something. He motioned to the crowd. When they were all silent, he said to them in Aramaic. Again, Greek is what he speaks, but Aramaic replaced the old Hebrew language. So he's speaking Aramaic, more of the Middle Eastern language there. And that's everybody. Jesus would have spoke Aramaic. Jesus probably would have spoke Greek. Jesus would have known Hebrew. "Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense. When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet," because he's not speaking to them in Greek. He's speaking to them in what is their native tongue. Again, they're Jews who were supposed to speak Hebrew, but it's morphed into, they began to speak Aramaic. "They became quiet." So the rioting crowd that was beating him, however long it took him to carry him from here to here, is now quiet and is listening to Paul begin his message. "Then Paul said, 'I am a Jew born of Tarshish of Cilicia, but was brought up in this city under Gamaliel.'" And we still know who Gamaliel is, historically a great teacher. And goes all the way through. You can see all that he tells, all about all the things that he did. He persecuted the church. Verse 6, "About noon I came near Damascus." Now he's going to talk about his conversion, where the Lord spoke to him. And they're still listening. A man named Ananias, in verse 21, an observer of the law and highly respected by all Jews living there. He healed him and got him back, gave him his sight back after he'd seen the Lord. Verse 14, "Then he said, 'The God of our fathers,'" he said, "then Ananias," in chapter 22, verse 14, "Ananias said to Paul," then he said, "Ananias said to Paul," Paul's quoting him, "'The God of our fathers,'" and notice what Paul, throughout this, Paul keeps talking about observing the law, the God of our fathers. He's talking as a Jew to Jewish people. He's not saying, "You need to become Christians." You can speak to the Jews without saying become a Christian. He's speaking to the Jews about their covenant with God, the promise of the Messiah. He's going, now, these are all promises given to Israel. All they've got to do is accept the truth of the Old Testament, and they'll accept Christ, which then, by default, then they would become a Christian. But he's not telling them they've got to become a Protestant. They've got to believe the Word. And so he's going through this, right? And that's why he's saying, "The God of our fathers has chosen you," Ananias had told Paul, "to know his will and to see the righteous one." That would be the Lord Jesus, "and to hear the words from his mouth. You will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. And now, What are you waiting for? Get up, be baptized, and wash your sins away, calling on his name. The name, and he doesn't say Jesus yet. He's talking, you know, he's not, he's talking about the righteous one. He's talking about Messiah. He's talking about the sins. All these things are prophecies that have been fulfilled. They were fulfilled in the man Jesus. But he's not slamming down the name Jesus right there. He's talking about the Jewish theology. When I returned to Jerusalem and was praying at the temple, I fell into a trance. And this is the only place we know anything about this. And saw the Lord speaking. Quick, he said to me, leave Jerusalem immediately because they will not accept your testimony about me. Get out of Jerusalem. And again, now watch it. Here's one of these Old Testament prophecies that is now being fulfilled. He says, get out of Jerusalem. They're not going to listen to you, Paul. Lord, I replied, these men know that I went from one synagogue. Now this here, see. Now we're all like this, and I don't want to read too much into this story, but Paul, this is his turf. I mean, he was born in Tarshish, but he was sent away to school probably as a 12-year-old in Jerusalem. You talk about going away to a private boarding school. He went here as was trained by the greatest Jewish teachers, including Gamaliel. Now, he's trained here. He grew up here in Jerusalem, probably between the ages of 12 and 30, and he was outstanding. Talk about being an outstanding lawyer, outstanding academic. He was the man. In fact, when the church began, he began to persecute the church because they're not following what he thought was the fulfillment of the scriptures, and he began to persecute them. So Paul feels this is where he belongs. This is his home turf. And in his mind, he always wants to come to Jerusalem. That may be one of the reasons why he wanted to bring the money. In fact, if we go back in Acts, five times on his way to Jerusalem, he is told by the Spirit, no, do not go. Or if you do go, you're going to be chained up. If you do go, you're going to be taken captive. It's within 7 days, all those prophecies are fulfilled, and he's now in chains, standing on Fort Antonia, speaking to Jews, thinking, this is my chance. This is what I've always wanted, is to share with the Jewish people. Once they hear me explain it, they will understand it. God just needs me to say something, and now this is his chance. And so he's working this. He's dancing around it. You can see the wording. Everything's fine. And he's saying, right here, the Lord came to him several years ago. It'd be like 38 AD around that time. Leave Jerusalem immediately because they will not accept your testimony about me. Verse 19, this is what Paul says to the Lord at that time, you know, like 10 years before. Lord, I replied, these men know that I went from one synagogue to another to imprison and beat those who believe in you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I stood there giving my approval and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him or stoning him to death. Then the Lord said to me, here it is, watch this. Then the Lord said to me, Paul says, go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles. The crowd, verse 22, listened to Paul until he said this. Then they raised their voices and shouted, rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live. Now, there is the break right there. As long as he was talking Jewish to them and talking the culture to them, but once, and it's in the Old Testament, the Gentiles, that's too small of a thing for the Messiah just to save Israel. I will also, he says, save the nations. I will also go out. And Isaiah talked about it. Even Gamaliel himself, who trained Paul, was open to and thought the Jews were a light to the Gentiles. It began in Genesis chapter 12. You're going to be a blessing through Israel. The Gentiles, the nations will be blessed. But when he says, go, God sent me, or this Messiah, the righteous one, appeared to me and says, go to the Gentiles, this crowd went berserk. Right there, that's what I wanted to point out. Eschatologically, we have now crossed over into, in this age, this is proof of it right here, that we're fulfilling Old Testament prophecy of going to the Gentiles with the word of the Messiah. Not just the Messiah coming and being resurrected, but the good news going to the Gentiles. And Paul, that's his whole ministry is based on that. Verse 22, the crowd listened to Paul until he said this. Then they raised their voices and shouted, rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live. As they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, the commander ordered Paul to be taken into the barracks. Now, you got to see this. This is just for your entertainment pleasure. He directed that he be flogged and questioned in order to find out why the people were shouting at him like this. Remember, he spoke to the commander in Greek. Can I say something to the people? Yes, he got permission. And then he begins to speak Aramaic. It's kind of like, and the commander's like, what is he saying? It's like, some guy's trying to interpret, keep up with Paul. And he's speaking Aramaic to his people. And it's like, well, things are going pretty good. Things are going pretty good. And all of a sudden, he's like, whoa, the chaos breaks out again. It's like, okay, well, I'm not sure what he said, but take him in and strap him down and let's start beating this guy. And that's what's taking place right here. You can just see the crowd wanting to beat him. The crowd's listening to him. The commander's listening to him. Now the crowd's listening to him. Now the commander wants to beat him. Now the crowd's upset. Okay, as they were shouting, throwing dust, flog the question in order to find out why the people were shouting like this. Verse 25, as they stretched him out to flog him. Now, this is not Paul's first time to be stretched out to be flogged. It happened multiple times from the Jews and the Romans. Now, but watch, he learned this in Philippi. Again, I'm not sure why he didn't say something in Philippi. Maybe he forgot. Maybe he didn't know it would work. Maybe he's trying to trust God. I'm not sure what he was doing. But watch how different it is than in Philippi. As they stretched him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, who the centurion would be the one watching the soldier stretch Paul out. He's the one observing. He's the one in charge now. Paul says to the centurion standing there, again, he's being stretched out. They're tying him up, pulling it tight. He says, is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty? When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported it. What are you going to do? He asked. This man is a Roman citizen. The commander went to Paul and asked, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? Paul says, yes, I am, he answered. Then the commander says, I had to pay a big price for my citizenship. So the commander is not, don't think the commander is a Roman from Rome that has come all the way over to Jerusalem. He's from Syria, or he's from somewhere in Israel, or some area that he was not born a citizen, but he had to purchase citizenship. And he had to write the check, and they gave him citizenship. Maybe for, he worked his way through the military, and now he's became a citizen. He said, I had to pay a big price for my citizenship. Paul then says, but I was born a citizen. Though, watch this, verse 29. Those who were about to question him withdrew immediately. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, in chains. This guy's all in chains, being stretched out, and even those were getting ready to question him, and they heard, he says, I was born a citizen. It's like, and everybody just like vaporizes. There's Paul and the commander. The commander's like, what? Let me see if I can find some keys. And I don't know if they use keys. But they're trying to get, it's like he's alarmed because of he's just stretched out. He could lose everything by doing that to Paul. Is that amazing? Okay. That only part I wanted you to see in chapter 22, I know we read a lot, was that the Gentiles, that Paul was going to the Gentiles. It was fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecy. And you see the tension. Now in 23, the commander is now going to have Paul meet before the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is going to answer some questions for the commander. He wants to know, what do I do with Paul? I mean, we have a riot here. We got something. Someone's guilty of something. You can't just start a riot. Did Paul instigate the riot? Did he say something? Did he do something? Of course, it's all made up. I mean, Paul did nothing except come up, take a vow, and someone started a rumor about it and got this whole thing going. Paul did nothing here except explain to the Jews what he was doing. And when he basically told them the gospel message, the purpose of the gospel, we're going to take this message to the Gentiles. And they went nuts again. And obviously the commander, the Roman commander, is like, what? He's not a terrorist. He didn't say anything wrong. He's going to go to the Gentiles with the message. And so he says, he decides the next day, let's take Paul and put Paul in front of the Sanhedrin. Now the Sanhedrin would be made up of several groups of people. These are the leaders. These are the scholars. They're the lawyers. They're the elders. They would be made up, and Paul, you're going to see this, they're going to be made up. There's going to be priests in this group. There's going to be Pharisees in this group. There's going to be Sadducees. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees are, it would be very simple for us, there's Republicans and there's Democrats. I mean, that would be a simple way of explaining it. The Pharisees would be the ones that accepted the whole text of Scripture. They're the ones that were more conservative. And it's almost like they're the results of the fallout, the leftovers of the Maccabean family, the revolt. Except the Sadducees were the wealthy. They're the priesthood. They accepted the first five books of the Bible, and they did not accept things like, resurrection. They didn't believe in angels, where the Pharisees did. The Sadducees would be more of the liberal group. You could also throw in there maybe some that would be Herodians, that would be supporting the line of Herod and Herod's reign, or even in support of Rome. And that's going to be part of the problem in 66 AD, in the Jewish wars break out, is these groups are going to start fighting each other. And they're not just fighting Rome. Some of them, there's civil war going to break out. In fact, Rome came in 63 B.C., to shut down the Jewish civil war. They were killing each other. These people were taking turns crucifying each other, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I mean, crucifying like they would crucify them and then watch their family be slaughtered while they're being crucified. That was their way of paying back each other. The Sadducees were also a part of the Maccabees fallout because they were the priesthood, and the Maccabees were the Hasmonean line, which were priests. So you've kind of got the theology and the culture going with the Pharisees. You've kind of got the priesthood and the royalty that they became going this way. Nonetheless, the Pharisees and Sadducees have got a 100-year more history of not just having disagreements, but having war with each other. Okay, so the commander, the Roman commander in Fort Antoninus, is going to bring Paul in before the Sanhedrin. And this will solve it. Chapter 22, verse 39. And the verse I'm shooting for, okay, it's not too far away. It's in verse 6 and 7. But in chapter 23, we're going to go in chapter 22, verse 30. The next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he still doesn't know why he was accused. And this false accusation, this confusion, is going to follow Paul for 5 years. You kind of think he should have listened, maybe don't go to Jerusalem. He released him and ordered the chief priest and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. So he, the commander, orders the Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish ruling class, and they may have met right about this location, just west of the Temple Mount. There's been some major excavation here where they found some very involved buildings. We've gone through some tunnels there and seen some, but since that time they've even expanded more and found some very elaborate rooms with mikvahs and stuff in it, where meeting rooms that maybe the Sanhedrin met here, or they could have met up here. There's speculation on where they met, but clearly it was a very prestigious place. And this would be a nice place to take Paul where they brought him. So he's going to now stand before the Sanhedrin, and the commander is going to have his team of lawyers watching and observing and finding out, what do I do with this Paul? Because the commander in charge of keeping peace in Jerusalem, and the Romans want peace. And if the commander can't keep peace, that's why Pilate was so concerned when the crowd started wanting to have Jesus killed, and he tried to, I'll give you Barabbas, I'll beat Jesus, I've questioned the man, there's nothing wrong, I have no legal basis to hold him. And they shouted, you know, we have no king but Caesar. And Pilate knew that there's going to be problems between him and the people, or amongst the people, if he didn't do something with Jesus. So I think it's pretty clear Pilate thought Jesus was innocent, that it was just religious jealousy that was coming against Jesus. But he also realized, if I lose control of these people, I will have fallout in my own life. I'll lose my position. And he does. He and his wife end up in exile later on because of the reason Pilate was in Jerusalem. This is not like a great place you want to be. This is like the beginning spot of your career. And Pilate had already been at some highlights and had kind of been shipped off here to prove that he could handle certain responsibility, and he did not want a problem. And so this commander's under the same kind of pressure. He's got to do something with this Paul guy that matches Jewish law with Roman law without causing a riot here. And we can't just burn the place to the ground. They eventually will, but nonetheless. Okay. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin. Now remember, Paul is now in his wheelhouse. I mean, we already saw Paul on Mars Hill talking to the Greek philosophers. We've seen him in the streets talking to people. We've seen him go through city after city of the Gentiles. And now this is where he should be. He should have a seat on the Sanhedrin. He should be one of these men making decisions. If anybody's going to win this battle, Paul is. Paul looks straight at the Sanhedrin. My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day. At this, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. So he says, everything I've done, I've done in good conscience. The high priest says, strike him. Now this, I don't understand this verse. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. Now I think that's completely appropriate. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. The high priest was in charge of overseeing this whole meeting of the Sanhedrin and making sure they followed the law and the letter of the law. But he now has Paul struck just because he didn't like what Paul says. You can't strike it. Jesus says the same thing. He says, you strike me, but he says, where are my accusers? He says, they said, we're punishing you for what you said. He said, I haven't said anything wrong. And so, you know, Jesus, you know, we say, Jesus, you know, turn the other cheek. But when they struck Jesus at Jesus' trial, the same Ananias, Jesus called him out. Says, why'd you strike me? You have no reason to strike me. He challenged them, and they got mad. Well, Paul's in the same situation. You saw what he says, and they have him struck. And the reason he says this to the Ananias, the high priest, is he's supposed to be observing the law, but he allowed the law to be broken. In fact, he commanded the law be broken and Paul be struck because that's what he wanted to do. So you can see the eliteness coming into the Sanhedrin through the high priest and the Sadducees, something you may want to keep an eye out in your own world. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. Those who are standing near Paul, and I think what Paul said is exactly right. Those who are standing near Paul said, you dare to insult God's high priest? Then Paul backs down right away. Paul replied, brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest, for it is written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people. So in the first case, Paul was right because the law was broken by the one who's supposed to be upholding the law. And what he said, calling it out, would be appropriate. But then when he's corrected, he says, I didn't know he was the high priest, because then he goes back to the law and says, it says you're not supposed to speak evil about your leadership. And he teaches that himself in Romans. So the options here on why did Paul say that is, one, some say Paul didn't recognize Ananias because he'd been gone for so many years, and you know, Ananias had gained some weight, you know, put on some years, lost some hair. And it's like, Ananias, I didn't know it was you. Maybe. Some say Paul had bad eyesight, and that it's like he couldn't see. And then that's, you can build on that, because he says something about when he had, talking to the Galatians, that while he was there, he was sick, and they would have torn out their eyes and gave it to him. So he's, well, Paul had bad eyesight. So maybe Paul, I can't see very good. I didn't know it was you. Others think he was being sarcastic, insulted him or challenged his authority. And then when they says he's the high priest, it's like, oh, I didn't even know he was the high priest, because that's not what a high priest would do. So I'm not supposed to say evil. If he would have been acting like the high priest, I wouldn't have had to say that to you. So in other words, the insults maybe continue. You know, you don't strike me. That's breaking the law. Oh, you're the high priest? Who would have known that a high priest would break the old law? I should not criticize you, because the Bible says, or the scripture says, you know. So somewhere in there is the answer, and I do not know the answer, and it may be something other than that. Either Ananias is old and he doesn't remember the high priest, the high priest has changed, Paul can't see him, or maybe he's not backing down, he's just hitting him like Paul was, just technically hitting him three different ways, at just like a great boxer. And it's like, well, anyway, I like to think that Paul's just slapping him three different ways. Then Paul, now watch this, I'm going to go with Paul's saying, Paul calls it out right here, you just broke the law, because Paul knows the Sanhedrin, he knows what's right. So I think he's calling the high priest out. And then when they say, you shouldn't say that to the high priest, that's why we struck you, it's like, if he would have been acting like a high priest, I wouldn't have said that, because I would have, you know, even if, because then he quotes the Bible. And then he goes into this fourth punch right here. I mean, Paul just takes the house down. Watch this. Here's the fourth punch. Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, my brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. Okay, what's wrong with that? Well, first of all, he says he's a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee. I'm on this side, and I've got a history of being on this side. So he's just going to dig up the entire 100 years of history. He says, you know, our families were killing each other over the last 100 years, fighting back and forth in these civil wars. That's why Rome came in. And then he pulls out one of the major theological differences. I stand here because of the resurrection of the dead. He's there because of Jesus Christ resurrected from the dead. And the Pharisees like, exactly, that's what we believe. The Sadducees say, that's impossible. We've already proved that theologically. That's not even an option. These guys are pro-creation. These guys are pro-evolution. I stand because I believe in creation. These guys know creation is a hoax or whatever. I mean, it's a major dividing point, the resurrection from the dead. So watch this. First, the high priest is coming apart. Now Paul says, I stand here because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. When he said this, verse 7, when he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. You thought it was bad here when the common Jews were riding on the Temple Mount. Paul's now brought into the Roman garrison, then now sent to the Sanhedrin, the ruling class. It's like, hey, let's start a riot here too. So this is where all the law and order comes from. He says, when he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees, now Luke puts in parentheses here, the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, and there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Verse 9, there was such an uproar here in the Sanhedrin being overseen by the high priest, being observed by the commander of the Roman garrison here in Jerusalem. There was such a commotion or an uproar, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously, we find nothing wrong with this man. So suddenly they're ready to make a decision. This man's innocent, they said. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him? The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces, not on the Temple Mount, but in the court of the Sanhedrin. Would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away. Now, this is if you say the Bible's not funny, this is humor. This is Luke writing humor, because you've got the mob here on the Temple Mount, and the stormtroopers go down and rescue Paul from the mob. They bring him in. They talk to him. They release him. Okay, everything's fine. Let's go to the Sanhedrin and find out what's wrong. They put Paul over here. They've got to rush down, go get Paul, and rescue him from the Sanhedrin so he's not torn apart. I mean, the Jews here or here are going to destroy Paul. And so the command is like, who is this guy? So, I mean, that's I think, just flat out humor right there. The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down and take him from them by force and bring him into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and says, take courage. As you've testified about me in Jerusalem, you must also testify in Rome. We're taking this case to Rome. And it's going to take him 3 years before he gets there, because in 57, 58, 59, 60, he's going to be held in Caesarea. And finally, he's not going anywhere. He's just in lockdown there. No, the case is just in slow motion. And so he's going to appeal to Caesar, and they'll put him on a prison ship, and he'll end up standing and talking to Nero. And that's what the Lord told him there that night. Okay, now in the rest of chapter 23, they're going to transfer him over to Caesarea Philippi. Do I got a picture of Caesarea Philippi here somewhere? Over on the coast, they're going to transfer him from Jerusalem over to the coast to Caesarea Philippi in a prison there. And that's where he's going to be held. And he's going to meet with the governor at that time is Felix. And then Festus is going to replace him. Felix is there in 57, 58. Festus is going to come in around 58, you know, say 60. Festus is going to be there. That's a new governor. They're stationed in Caesarea by the sea. And then while Festus is there, Herod Agrippa II is going to come visit with Beatrice, his sister. Herod Agrippa is king up north, or he's got a territory up north, by Dan, north of the Sea of Galilee. I walked through his palace one day, the remains of his palace. They found his palace up there, magnificent place. I was there by myself just walking through it. And they were putting a new highway in. And as they put the highway in, they started going through this remains, and they uncovered this magnificent palace of Herod Agrippa. Well, Paul is going to talk to Felix, Festus, and Herod, and that's where during these next 3 years, 57, 58, 59. And from this chapter right here, so now the issue is going to be taking Paul from Jerusalem over to Caesarea, and the Jews are going to plan assassination attempts. They're going to try to get him transported back to Jerusalem. And these guys are Romans. Herod Agrippa is a Gentile, but very observant of the law. And so that's what you're going to see in chapter 23. In my NIV Bible, the title is A Plot to Kill Paul. They're going to try to assassinate him. Then verse 23 of chapter 23, Paul is transferred to Caesarea. And here's the letter the governor wrote. And there you can see the names of some people there. And what we've seen so far, the only thing, I'm sorry, but the only thing we've talked about eschatologically that is, but it's rich in these stories, is two things. The Gentiles, the gospel is going to the Gentiles. Paul is taking to the Gentiles. And Paul is, he based his whole concept on the resurrection. His whole court case there, I believe in the resurrection of the dead. Now again, notice the Sadducees coming, they're the priesthood. The priests were mostly Sadducees. The priesthood rejected the concept of the resurrection because they only held to the first five books. So this resurrection is actually a new teaching, an advancement, a stretch form, although we can trace it from Daniel. We can go back to Genesis. We can go to Job. We see the resurrection. David talked about it. We see the resurrection in the Old Testament, but they had filtered it out. The Pharisees accepted it, and Paul is now making that a cornerstone of this. And the resurrection is an event that's yet to take place. Jesus has been resurrected, but our hope is in our own resurrection, which Jesus will take place, take care of in the future. Now, we're going to go to chapter 24. Chapter 24, and now he's on trial before Felix. Chapter 24 in my NIV, the title of this is The Trial Before Felix. 5 days later, and again, all this is, you know, 7 days later, 5 days later, 2 days later, or the next day. So you almost got like a month calendar going on right here. Chapter 24, verse 1. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus. And they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. Now, the Jews are going to go ahead and take their case from Jerusalem over to Caesarea. When he goes into lockup right there, Paul is eventually, after 3 years, going to say, I appeal my case to Nero. And he's going to then, a Roman citizen, they could take their case and appeal it to Nero if you want to wait in line. And so Paul's going to go, that's where he has the prison ship, it has a shipwreck, and that's another whole story. But when he gets there, he appears before Nero, but it doesn't appear the Jews made the effort to follow him all the way to Rome to present their case. But they're going to go talk to Felix, the governor of, this is this guy, Felix and Festus are in the place Pilate was in 30 AD. They're the governor, the proconsul. And their lawyer is Tertullus. When Paul was called in, and the verse I'm looking for here, I'm going to make sure I get this, 24 verse 14. So I've got a ways to go. Are you ready? Here we go. Here's Paul. Now, this is Paul, the lawyer, talking, not to the Sanhedrin, not to the Jews in the Temple Mount, not to the Church of Corinth. This is him talking to a government official, a Roman government official, about his own personal case. Now, again, what's interesting about this is very accurate. Because this is not second-hand or third-hand information. Luke was traveling with Paul during these days. So Paul's not telling him, this is what happened, it happened something like this, I said something like this, and Luke's putting it into story form. Luke is there watching. Luke is documenting these things. In fact, if you don't mind me saying it, Luke writes his letter, or the Gospel of Luke, 57 to 60 A.D., he writes a letter, or writes the Gospel of Luke sometime. But he says at the beginning of the book of Luke, in the Gospel of Luke, Luke writes, I have carefully investigated and checked out all the stories. In other words, there was, by 57 AD, you can imagine there were some stories about Jesus that were just like this stories. That never happened. But Luke went around and checked. He talks about he spoke with eyewitnesses. He's going to have first-hand accounts. The book of Luke, the Gospel of Luke, is a first-hand account. He asked people questions and wrote down. That's why you got stuff that Mary said this, or Mary thought this, or Mary prayed this. It's like, how does Luke know this? Well, God's just giving him inspiration. Well, his words are inspired by God, his writing, but he would have been able to talk to Mary about what the angel says, what she said to Elizabeth, what it was like raising Jesus. He had all this information. He could have talked to the blind men that were healed. He could have talked to the lepers. He could have talked to Lazarus who had been raised from the dead. Luke could have checked out a ton of stories. And Luke, being a historian and being hired by one named Theophilus to write an orderly account, he went through and did a thorough job. Now, he's probably writing this, and while Paul's sitting in prison, he's probably researching in Jerusalem. Luke is from Asia Minor. He's from Troas, ancient Troy. So he's now in the Holy Land right now with living witnesses. I mean, don't you wish you could go to the Holy Land? That'd be cool. Don't you wish you could go to the Holy Land in 57 AD and talk to all these people that knew Jesus? Well, there's Luke, and he's doing this very thing, and he's got 3 years to write these things down. And this is probably when he wrote the book of Luke. And then between 60 and 62, he's on the prison ship with Paul. He ends up in Rome. He's with Paul under the house arrest. And that's where he writes the history of everything he did with Paul in the book of Acts, including these events. And the book of Acts ends with Paul still under house arrest in 62 AD. So you know when Luke stopped writing the book of Acts is in 62 AD. Where's the rest of the story? Well, I quit writing. And so this is right here, when we've got this written down here, this account, this is stinking amazing, because it doesn't say this, but it's very possible Luke was sitting there in the gallery there listening to the court case, listening to the Tertullus and Felix and Paul, and he's just taking notes. I mean, it's like, how do you know he said that? I watched it. I was there. So anyway, when Paul was called in, chapter 24, verse 2, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about... Okay, excuse me. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case. Okay, this is Tertullus talking right here. Is this correct? Yes, okay. We have enjoyed your foresight everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix. Now, interesting, if you don't care, I'm sorry. Most excellent Felix, in other words, Tertullus, the Jewish lawyer, complimenting Felix for doing and calls him most excellent. And here it's the Greek word is, I've got it here written in my notes. But if you go back to the beginning of the book of Acts, and I'm not going to have you do that, but chapter 1, verse 1 right there, he calls Theophilus, the one he's writing, most excellent Theophilus. So if Felix is called most excellent, it wasn't just you find outstanding young man type of a term. It was a term for nobility. It's a term of some kind of note of society. Felix is most excellent. The book that Luke is writing, the book of Acts and the book of Luke, for most excellent Theophilus. So it's possible Theophilus was the one financing and had become a believer and wanted to know without a shadow of a doubt what really happened. And he wants a historical document. And that's what Luke is writing, a historical document for most excellent Theophilus. And that's, you can see it in the book. So nonetheless, that's an amazing word right there, most excellent, because it ties right into Theophilus, who this book is being written for, and who is probably financing Luke's efforts. Okay, we found that this man to be a troublemaker, verse 5, stirring up riots among the Jews all around the world. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect. Notice right there, they're not called Christians or followers of Jesus or Jesus people. They're called the Nazarene sect. Jesus was from Nazareth, and he was the Nazarite, and so, you know, he was the guy from Nazareth. And they were called the Nazarene sect. It was a group that had broken away from mainline Judaism, and they had their own little Nazarene sect. We call it Christianity. And even tried to desecrate the temple. So we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him. The Jews joined in the accusation, asserting that these things were true. So he called witness after witness, and they're all pointing fingers at Paul. This is what he does. This is what he said. This is what he did to my family. When the governor motioned for him to speak, so in other words, okay, they rest their case. Okay, Paul, go ahead. Paul replied, I know that, okay, the verse we're looking for is 14 and 16. I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation. A judge, governor, proconsul. So I gladly make my defense. Now, Paul's a lawyer. Now he's on defense. You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship. So now we know how long this has been going. This is 12 days worth of details. That's a lot of words, a lot of court cases for 12 days, a lot of activity. I mean, if I had 12 days in my life like this, I might have a movie contract. I went up to Jerusalem to worship. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple. He was there to pay his vow and fulfill his vow. Or stirring up a crowd. He wasn't preaching in the temple courts. Jesus did that a couple times, but Paul wasn't. Or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city. And they cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me. Meaning that I brought a Gentile in. They cannot prove this. And they can't because no one saw it because it didn't happen. However, I admit that I worship the God of our... Now, here you go. He says, this is my case. Now, however, since I've got your attention... Now this is where, and you know he did this to Nero. However, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers. As a follower of the way, he calls the Nazarene sect, he calls it the way. It's the same thing, it's just two ways of looking at it, which they call a sect. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets. And I have the same, hope in God as these men, the Jews. In other words, we are on the same page. These Jews, the high priest, Ananias is there, the lawyer they brought, we are on the same page. We have the same hope in God as these men. And that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. Now he adds to that, not just a resurrection, but a resurrection of the righteous and a resurrection of the wicked. Meaning they're going in two different directions, two different fates. He said, I believe in the resurrection just like these men do. And again, he's pushing them there, assuming that they believe the law and the prophets. And the Sadducees, they don't believe all the prophets. They don't believe Daniel. They believe the first five books. So he's dragging them along with him into the full context of the scripture. And have the same hope in God as these men, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. After an absence of several years, now you're going to go through this whole thing with his conversion, bringing the offering. Again, I could read that. Maybe I should. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. And it's that money he was bringing down from the Gentile churches. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. I went through all the rituals, had a 7-day break, remember? There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. You mean the Jews that saw it, that they didn't see, they're the ones, they're not there in court. And I doubt that they went all the way to Rome. Or these who are here should state what crime they found in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin. Unless it was this one thing I shouted as I stood in their presence. I shouted, it is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today. Notice he's hinging everything on the resurrection of the dead. Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, Luke writes. So Felix was well acquainted with the way. Adjourn the proceedings. When Lysias, the commander, comes, he says, I will decide your case. Now we find the name of the commander in Jerusalem was Lysias. I will decide your case. He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. That would include Luke and others. Several days later, Felix came with his wife, Drusilla, who was a Jewess. So Felix had married a Jew. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and says, that's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe so that he would send for him freely and talk to him. So during this time period, this 2 years that Felix was there, he even brought his wife in. Says, listen to this guy. And Paul's not going to be talking about himself, and it wasn't fair, they didn't treat me right, I didn't do anything. He's going to bypass all that, and he's going to start talking, well, you saw it there. He's going to talk about righteousness and the judgment, and it's so much. So he's preaching, and Felix is bringing him in several times, one to hear him preach, but also, I mean, if you get me, you got friends come, I'm letting your friends come see you. They're bringing you food, they're bringing you books to read, and they're bringing you some cash. You give me some of that cash, I can solve this today. And he never did. Okay, man, I am running out of time here. I don't want to spend a fourth week on this. Okay, verse 27. We'll quit with this. When 2 years had passed. So Paul's there for 2 years doing this thing, this song and dance for Felix. Felix was succeeded by Proclus Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. He knows if he leaves Paul out, it's going to cause commotion. So just keep him in prison. And we're not sure what if Paul wrote any books. It's worth saying, some people consider when Paul talks about his chains and being in prison in the book of Ephesians and Colossians, it's possible that they're written from Caesarea. I don't think so. But it's a fair consideration that Paul's writing letters back to his churches over in Asia Minor from Caesarea. I think he writes them from Rome, and there's especially Philippians. There's several indications there. But it's worth taking, considering that option. I know some people that think they came from, and they try and date them from that time period. Okay, now next week, I can't believe this. I mean, I looked at these four verses, and I thought, I'm going to be done like 20 after 7, and I'm just going to stand behind, I have nothing to say. But here it is, 8 o'clock. We're going to pick up, because look at chapter 25, after 2 years. It says, 3 days after arriving in the province, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and the Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented the charges against Paul. They urgently requested Festus as a favor to them to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem. So Paul's been sitting in Caesarea for 2 years talking to Felix. When Festus comes in, he goes up after 2 years. It says after 3 days, he was in office there in Caesarea. He goes up to meet with everybody in Jerusalem. And one of the things that the leaders of Jerusalem bring up first, one of the first things is, hey, can you do us a favor? We want to put Paul on trial here in Jerusalem. Felix kept him there in Caesarea. Can you bring him back up here in Jerusalem so we can have a fair trial? Now, one of the reasons they want him to have him up there is they want to kill him on the way up there. I mean, if I was in prison for 2 years, I would hope I would still have enemies wanting to find me and punish me. Instead of just, if I'm in prison for 2 years, think anybody would remember me after 2 years? I mean, Tony would. My boys would have a vague recollection of it. But it's like after 2 years of being in prison, I mean, even the people that put me in prison would be like, what was that case? Paul, they're waiting. They're still so adamant against Paul that after 2 years, they want him to come back up to Jerusalem so they can kill him. I mean, if a guy's in prison, I mean, he's in prison. Let him sit. Anyway, we'll pick this up next week. But one of the things that we're seeing here is Paul talking about the resurrection. And again, it's eschatology because he's laying down some things about eschatology. It's more in the story form, but he's talking about the Gentiles and the resurrection. We got one more week in Acts, and then, my friends, we will be in the book of Romans and try and iron out some things or sift out of the book of Romans some eschatological references, and we'll march on through the New Testament. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate your patience as I stumble through these verses. I'll pray, and I appreciate your time. Father, I do thank you again for being here. I thank you for the chance to have your presence in the Word and in our hearts as we look at these things. We ask that your Spirit would bring to life the things that you've said to us in these words, that we would be able to find application in our own lives and find direction. We do thank you for the fact that we are alive, living in these times with the chance to live a life empowered by the Spirit of God, and ask that we would be a light even to the people of our own generation, our own time, the places we go, the people we see, that again, they may be able to recognize your presence in this earth, you being the Creator, being the Savior. And Father, we do again thank you for the chance to do these things and ask for revival in our land, revival in our churches, that again, we may continue to proclaim the good news of Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.